Okay, so basically the study of marriage, divorce, and remarriage, Jesus' teaching and all of that teaching that is contained in both the Old and New Testaments is extremely complex, not necessarily because the principles themselves are difficult, but because there is much error that is taught and there are so many scenarios, so many either hypothetical or actual situations that people get themselves into that cause make you almost have to be Solomon to be able to be consistent with regard to the applications of the principles. So we're not going to be able to cover it exhaustively. We did spend an entire hour on that. Is there anything about the text in Matthew 5:31 and 32 or anything that is especially troubling to you that you want to bring up before we go on? Do keep in mind it's going to be a number of weeks from now before we do it, but we will have an opportunity in the future to study in Matthew the 19th chapter his teaching on that particular issue, and we'll revisit some of these things at that time. But is there anything else that anybody needs? Yes, Ben?
I have no problem with 32. I understand it. You know, fine. But I have never really understood verse 41, Deuteronomy 24:1. Do you have a simple explanation for why Moses allowed the writing of divorce? And not only that, but it's actually in the law.
Yeah, I mentioned, and I'm not sure if it's a sufficient explanation, but last week, what I get as far as an understanding of the reason why Deuteronomy 24 is there is twofold. Number one, Jesus specifically said in Matthew 19 it was because of the hardness of their hearts. So it was the hardness of hearts among the Jews. And then you go to Acts chapter 17, and the fact that there were certain allowances that God made before that he no longer makes. So that would be my explanation, is that because of the hardness of the hearts of the Jews, there were practices that were ongoing. You know, I don't want to put words in God's mouth, certainly, in that, and try to speculate too far. But what was obvious is that the Jews were doing what they wanted with regard to marriage. Okay. And the hardest of the hearts would be the indication that if a law is made to say stop doing that, it would be an ignored law. But there were protections that are afforded the wife in Deuteronomy chapter 24.
Yeah, because the children always had a hard heart. They were always hard heart. Idolatry. God never legalized idolatry. And yet they always struggle with that. That's what caused them to go into captivity.
Right.
But protecting the wife, because she was going to be treated treacherously, as the prophet says, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think so. So there's a term that you use, mitigating, and I think that the purpose of that law was to mitigate the damage that was being done to the woman in that society, and that's the reason why Moses allowed it. Because that's, you know, Jesus is the best commentator on it. Matthew 19 tells us that Moses allowed it, and indicating from that Moses wasn't on board with what they were doing. But Moses allowed it, and he allowed it because of the state of Israel at that time, that they had hard hearts. But he said from the beginning that was not God's intent. And he was restating or reestablishing what was so from the beginning. Yes, Caroline?
I think it's interesting from Matthew 19, it's pretty clear that the Jews didn't take this as a blanket permission to divorce. Else it wouldn't have been a test. There was something about the question.
Some did and some didn't. And I think at that particular time, from what I understand at that time, there were basically two schools of thought. With regard to the, was it an uncleanness that they found in her? I forget now exactly the wording of Deuteronomy 24.
Indecency.
And some were giving a very broad view of that it basically would allow anything that displeases the husband to be basis for divorce. And then there was another school that was pretty much toeing the line with regard to God's view of it, that indecency would be sexual immorality on the part of a woman.
it's interesting. If you go back just a few chapters before that, if a man married a woman and accused her of impurity, and the parents could prove that she was pure, he couldn't divorce her the rest of her life. So that's interesting right there, that there were certain ramifications. I guess it's because, again, protections for the wife. Because if he was able to divorce her, then she may never be able to find another husband with that shadowing over her. Huh?
Certainly, yeah. And that was, again, something that was protected with the woman. Yeah, there again in Matthew chapter 19, that was the question, is it lawful to divorce a woman for just any cause? And that was the big issue at their time, and Jesus said no. Yeah, the one interesting thing about Matthew 19, we're getting into that text a little bit, but the interesting thing about that is that his answer was very concise. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause? No. Go on from there. That answered the question. And it wasn't until they said, well, why then did Moses command us? And his answer was, Moses didn't command it. Moses allowed it because you're hard hearts. But from the beginning, it wasn't so. And I say to you, so there is that reestablishing the truth that really was there from the beginning. But there was there were some allowances that were made, again, at that time by Moses that Jesus is not going to allow. And so I say to you is establishing what God requires of us, certainly today under the new covenant. Okay, anybody else about marriage?
I was kind of wondering about this. Is that in three of the Gospels, it goes into about divorce and remarriage and only one exception and all that. But we go into the epistles on that, except for Romans 7, not that we need any more than what's in the Gospels and Romans, that about the divorce and marriage. But I was kind of wondering why it didn't go in more detail, as they did in the Gospels.
Well, that would be somewhat speculative on our part, except for the fact that Jesus did a good enough job, I would say. I think that the question that was asked in 1 Corinthians 7, which is the other issue of dispute, I think basically, although we don't have the question stated, what Paul was doing is answering questions that have been given him, and we don't have the questions themselves, we just have his answers. But it seems to indicate that what the Christians of Corinth were asking is, all of these things that Jesus taught, do they apply when you've got a Christian marrying a non-Christian, who's married to a non-Christian? Do they apply in that situation as well? And there are some specific problems with that idea. You've got two non-Christians, one becomes a Christian, the other one doesn't like it. Okay, now that's going to cause a conflict in the marriage, and what do we do now? And so Paul gave some instructions with regard to that. But those instructions in no way abrogate what Jesus taught, which was a very simple rule that we have already established: one man, one woman for a lifetime. And that's kind of that's the way I like to think of it, because it stated so clearly. So that would be my only suggestion, is that there wasn't much need to go into more detail about it when Jesus has spoken so in such a straightforward and complete fashion on the matter. Yes, Josh.
Before I get into my two points, I wanted to answer Dick. Jesus laid down the what, or the do and don't do of the matter. He said, basically what he just said, but Paul and the other apostles, they more or less just go into the how to not get into the situation where the rule needs to apply to you to begin with. Learn how to treat your spouse so they don't feel compelled to chase after things that aren't theirs. Or learn how to not treat your spouse. Just whatever. Just learn how to be a good person that will strengthen the relationship, so one, you don't desire to do something wrong, and they don't desire to do something wrong. So Jesus did lay down the what. The rest of it's just how to be a good person. I walked in at a time that raised a question that I didn't know that I had, and then I had another question. The first question is relating specifically to Moses. It says Moses allowed it. Was this Moses being truly what he's called, a lawgiver, or versus the avenue through which the law came?
Yeah, I think when Moses is referred to as the giver of that first covenant, and rightfully so. I don't think that what Moses was doing was in any way outside of the purview of God's authority.
Okay. All right. Second question was, I had it from last week. We just ran out of time. I've heard both sides argued, and I see both sides on their technical sides, but my thought is the verses clearly state that adulterers don't have the right to marry someone else other than their original spouse. Well, I heard the case argued for one who had never been married before, but he had married somebody else's wife. Well, they found out they couldn't be in that relationship. Well, later on, he decides he wants to be in another relationship. Yet, he's been in an adulterous relationship. Would he have that right, having previously been an adulterer?
Why do you bring these up? That's part of what we're talking about, going everywhere. Let me just make a quick statement and about this. I think that question is answered in Romans 7. And I think that it has to do with what we referred to last week as the marriage bond. So you have a situation to where, though they were married, there is no marriage bond, because there cannot be, because she is bound to another. If her husband lives, she's bound to her husband. If she marries another, she'll be called an adulteress. The text indicates, too, that he's guilty of adultery, because he who marries her, who is put away, is guilty. But in other words, that there's that situation. But in that case, this is the way I understand it, though I must admit it churns my stomach to think this, is that he would have the right to marry because he is not bound nor never has been bound. So that marriage bond is what constitutes an adulterous relationship. And since he's never been bound and was not bound to her even though they were married, then he would have the right to remarry. Now, having said that, there's no way that I could in good conscience do that.
Sure.
It's just my understanding of the text. And when individuals would use that as an excuse, I mean, that's something that really bothers me. But that's my understanding of the text. That's the marriage bond. And one you've not been bound to, if you've never been bound, then you would have a right to marry.
Okay. Right.
That's understandable.
That's fair enough.
Just,
I had a thought. Dangerous, I know. But I had a thought, and it's interesting how these different versions of the Bible, whatever, ESV, King James, New King James, Jones Literal. And one of the reasons is so that I can read it kind of afresh. Because I got dangerously close to memorizing like half of the New Testament in King James before I started using other things. And I'd read it and like even in just the King James, I'd be like, whoa, that doesn't sound at all like what I thought the New King James meant. And so I was reading it this time, whatever, I read it hundreds of times. And I thought to myself, what if Jesus wasn't saying anything different than Moses at all? What if Jesus was just explaining what Moses had said all along? So they ask him, hey, can you go and divorce for the same reason? He goes, haven't you read the Bible? Adam and Eve joined together, one flesh, you're supposed to stay together. He said, well, why did Moses come and say that you can have this root of divorce? Well, it's because of the hardness of your heart. That's why he did it. And I'm telling you,
that what Moses was saying was, if you divorce for any reason other than uncleanness, then you're not following the law of Moses. That's what he's talking about. He said uncleanness or impurity or you know, it's translated in ways. The same he's talking about. He's talking about fornication. That's what he's talking about. And if you have been doing it all this time, back in whatever, the time of David or the time of, you know, Isaiah or the time of whoever, if you were doing it for some reason other than fornication, that wasn't what Moses was talking about. The rule hasn't changed. And it's Dennis's fault I thought of it.
Yeah.
Because it didn't make any sense. How would God go and say, well, it's always been wrong to divorce for a reason other than fornication, but Moses said, meh, you can sin for a while, but we're going to tighten the rules back up later.
Well, he didn't say that. No, but again, he would. This is the problem that I have with that view. Is, and I recognize what you're saying, and certainly has always been God's intent. The one man, one woman for a lifetime from Genesis. We see that that's the case. But there is a contrast that is made between what Moses allowed and what was from the beginning. So there's a change there in some sense or some part. That there was a practice that was allowed that was not intended from the beginning, allowed by Moses. So there is that contrast that is made. This is a part of the law. So whatever whatever you say with regard to the teaching that we're trying to establish as being our teaching today, it seems that it's obvious to me from Matthew chapter 19 is there was what God intended, what was practiced by the Jews, and what Jesus is reestablishing. From the beginning it was not so. Moses allowed it, but I say to you.
Amen.
So, where's the "but I say to you"?
Well, I mean, it may not be explicitly stated there. The idea is...
Verse 9.
I say to you, and I say to you. Yeah. So I knew it was there, but I'm just saying that...
There's a big difference between and but, though.
Okay, well, what I intended was that, still, that contrast. It was that way, something, an interpolation for a while, whatever that interpolation was, that was authored by Moses, and now I say to you, which is a reversion to what was in the beginning.
But the alternative would be that nobody was allowed to divorce at all for any reason prior to the law of Moses. It was changed, the law of Moses. Jesus is describing the change.
But
were they further bound at that moment? They were still under the law of Moses.
I think they were doing things that were unlawful in God's eyes, and God used Moses to mitigate the damage being done to the woman. That was the purpose of Deuteronomy 24.
Stan talking about this, kind of like talking about the infirmities that Paul had.
Well, I mean, yeah, and I get that because we can get into the weeds too much for sure.
It doesn't apply to us what Moses did at the time. We know what the law, the marriage law is that applies to us. I don't know why Moses allowed it, but it's what he said. The Bible says he allowed it for the hardness of their hearts.
Well, that's the why.
That's
at least in part.
That's the why. So, it's not going to affect it. We're not going to change anything as far as the law is our concerns.
Yeah.
We talk about it all week.
Well, the problem is, and this is where it comes from time to time, is when individuals will seek to use some of this that is difficult to weed through in an attempt to overturn the plain statements concerning the lifetime commitment that you're making when you get married, and that's why we sometimes have to do that. Sometimes we have to go through the weeds because you've got a false teacher who's going through the weeds, coming out the other side. That okay, I can here's another cause or another exception or another reason. And it gets as we talked about last week, to the point where when you look at all of the different positions that are held on marriage, divorce, remarriage, Now, there can be an extreme on both sides. So someone can get to the idea, as Justin kind of alluded to, that you can't divorce for any reason at all. And, I mean, the exception is there, black and white, but some would say that it's not acceptable at any time. But most often, because it's just like with the ascetics and the libertines, more people like to have a good time than to make themselves miserable physically. Most of the time, the views that are held by men that diverge from truth are held because of a motivation to enlarge the pool of individuals who have the right to divorce and remarry. And typically that's where those positions and doctrines, whether it be non-Christians not amenable to God's law or Christ's law in this particular matter, or redefining adultery, or the Pauline privilege of 1 Corinthians 7, or these, that, you know, all these different things, it kind of makes that law, which his disciples, Matthew 19, says is a really, really hard law to accept, makes it easier and in some cases toothless. I mean, one of the common views is if the bond is broken for one, it's broken for the other, which basically means that I'm unfaithful to my wife, she puts me away, I'm married and I'm committing adultery because I'm married. She has the right to put me away. She has the right to remarry. She remarries. Well, now the bond's broken. If it's broken for her, it's broken for me. Now, so all of a sudden, I'm not an adulterer anymore. And which basically almost covers everybody, at least when another marriage is entered into. And so those are the kinds of things that we're talking about, and we need to keep in mind and keep at our forefront, even when we try to wade through some of these things, that what Jesus is saying here and in Mark and in Luke, Matthew 19, again and again and again, is that God intended for a man and his wife to marry, become one flesh, and not to be parted except in death. That's his intent with regard to marriage. It's a lifetime commitment. Yes, Chris.
Something that, kind of reiterating uncertainty that I've been asked you about it before, and all I got was, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, was the response, but does the woman really have the same right as the man?
Yeah, I think Mark 10 teaches that she does. Again, if you go over to Mark, the 10th chapter, what you'll find there in verses 11 and 12 is the fact that Jesus, and by the way, this is an interesting question, can the man has all these rights, and typically when you have writing, especially writing at this time, it's from a patristic society. A lot of times people are upset about that. They want to make the Bible gender neutral, those kinds of things. The writing typically is masculine. The writing that I do, in keeping with that tradition, is typically masculine. When I talk about mankind, I'm including women in that phrase. But that's a legitimate question to ask, because in the first century, there's no evidence either in Jewish nor Roman law, if I understand the historical references correctly, that a woman had the right to divorce. But in this case, Jesus turns it around, and in verse 11 he says, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her, and if a woman divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. Now, again, the exceptions are not found there, but there is that reality that what's good for the goose is good for the gander in this sense, that the same rule applies to both men and women. And I do think there are other things that come into mind. We're talking about spiritual concepts. We're talking about right and wrong, sin, and the idea that in that, that the woman would not have that same right that the man has. It strikes me as being troublesome.
I mean, because the woman was made for the man.
So no, I understand that.
That's another thing.
I'm just saying that if you've got a situation to where a woman has been unfaithful to her husband, and he has the right to put her away, but the man has been unfaithful to the woman, she doesn't have the right to put him away. That number one, I think Mark 10 indicates clearly that right would exist. But two, I think the concept of equity and fairness on the part of God would require that principle to be true as well. And I know that's a more that's not a direct argument; it's a more of a circuitous reference. But I think God's fairness and and in that regard would be something that would come into play. Bob got hands going everywhere now.
Well, let me answer a possible explanation from Mark. Donna's remembering that Roman women of a certain class had the right to divorce a husband under Roman law. Mark wrote it to the Romans.
Okay, that may be the case. I was not under that impression, but I very obviously could be wrong. Yes,
just to jump by real quick to what Justin said, and your response to it, if I may, about, well, was the difference between beginning and Moses, and then from Moses to Jesus, and then after Jesus, and why was it different? And I don't think that the only reason why we have to wrestle with a question like that is so we can refute these hypothetical situations that are thrown to try to justify divorce. I think it's a really valid question. And, I mean, it's the reason why we study the old law period, is to learn about who is God and how does he work and what does it mean in times of ignorance he overlooked but now commands all to repent. So it's like, was it not wrong to do this when they didn't have the law? And is there some standard of morality that's always the same but you're not necessarily held accountable to it? So I just wanted to throw that out there.
I agree. And much of the teaching that you have in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount is teaching that corroborates principles that are established in the law or further explains those things. I just resist the idea that Jesus was not establishing by his own authority teaching that is applicable to us today. Which is, again, a view that some would go so far as to take. And whenever he says, I say to you, whether it's establishing the principle of love your neighbor, which was one that was found under the law, or if it was establishing something that, for example, with regard to his words about the uncleanness of food and his statement that what goes into the belly does not defile a man. That was not something that was understood by the Jew because of the laws that govern them with regard to what it is they could eat clean and unclean meat. And Jesus was establishing principles that guided our understanding of the new covenant and were important, according to Peter, for example, in Acts 10. So I just don't want us to set aside those statements, the I say to you, as being, this is coming from me, and this is true. And again, when we get into it, in just a few moments, hey, if we get there, but with regard to this eye for the eye and tooth for tooth, tooth for tooth, there was teaching done in the Old Testament. There were applications of that teaching that were mistaken, and there were Jesus statements in that with regard to what he required of his disciples. And so I think some distinctions can be made in that regard. Not always, though. I mean, again, a lot of times it's simply he's explaining principles that were true under the Old Covenant, true under the New as well. And many times, in fact, most of the time, I would say. And some of that. Justin?
I just want to make 1,000,000% clear that I was not saying that.
Okay.
Like the thing you said, you want to make sure that we're not saying that Jesus wasn't, making principles that were still in there. I wasn't saying that.
Okay.
And my question would, if it were correct, would only strengthen the passage.
Well, in reestablishing what was taught from the beginning, again, God's intent has always been that, and it was during that time, even when the Jews were practicing something that was different. His intent was one man, one woman for a lifetime.
We're certain that about those we have to keep in mind about John the Baptizer, why he lost his head, you know why he lost his John the Baptizer, why he lost his head.
Lust of the king.
Huh?
The lust of the king. And hasty promises made. What are you trying to get to?
No, it said that you can't have him as your wife.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I mean...
Yeah, they didn't like his preaching, in other words, right?
Well, no, what I was pointing out is that when Moses said this, but it wasn't divine at all. I mean, it wasn't always that way after that because it was an unscriptural divorce that they had. Yeah. You know, a wife, you should say. And then as far as talking about what you're a faithful, knowledgeable Christian, we wouldn't question about we accept what's in the words of Jesus in the Gospels is binding just as much as in the epistles. But there's those that don't, they don't, some of them don't understand that, yeah.
I'm arbitrarily bringing an end to this discussion. Let's go on to verse 38. 38 through 42. You have heard that it was said. No, I'm sorry. 33 through 37. I was trying to jump in. Forbidding of oaths. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oath to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it's God's throne, nor by earth, for it's his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Okay, so there are two things that come into play with regard to this particular discussion. The first one is the fact that what was being practiced again with regard to swearing is something that Jesus did not condone. We'll talk about that for a moment. But the question, obvious question that comes is, can then a Christian in a court of law or by signing an affidavit swear or affirm an oath, whether it be to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, or whatever, or is that something that is sinful? So, a couple of things that I want you to note at the beginning, and which will kind of lead into that question. What Jesus is here again doing is elevating that concept of righteousness and right and wrong above what certainly was in common practice in that day. Reading from, I think it's Curtis Pope is his name, and his commentary on Matthew, he indicated that the Jews had developed elaborate levels of oaths. And there is mentioned in this particular text, don't swear by heaven, nor by earth, nor by Jerusalem, nor by your head. So there are four examples of that. And in the Mishnah, which is Jewish interpretation of law and practices that they held to, the Mishnah taught that a man could be exempted from liability in the breaking of an oath if the oath was made under heaven and earth rather than a specific oath that was made to God. In other words, there are promises, and then there are promises, and that there is a distinction that can be made so that kind of the way there are people who today think, and you see this in politicians and legal things, it's one thing to tell a lie, it's another thing to tell a lie under oath or tell a lie in a court of law, because there are greater consequences, for example, with regard to that. And so I just want you to note the contrast first that I think is significant in this, and that is that with Christ's disciples, there should never be, number one, a need to perform an oath or to make to bolster a promise by swearing, because whenever a promise is made, that promise is absolute on the part of the disciple. That is, when we say we're going to do something or we say that something is true, we have to be completely and totally honest. That lying is not, never has been, never will be acceptable. It is certainly beneath the disciple. And so the practice of swearing by heaven or earth or Jerusalem, or the interesting thing, his statement, swearing on your own head, how are you going to swear on your own head? You can't control what's on your head. You can't turn a hair white or black. It kind of reminds me of James 4, where individuals made this determination, we're going to such and such a city and buy and sell and spend a year there. He said, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You have no control over those kinds of things. And so there are those kinds of things to kind of keep in mind, is that this was a practice that was prevalent in that day. And he said, for a Christian, for a disciple, that shouldn't be the way you are. Your honesty and integrity should be absolute. And when you say yes, you better mean yes. When you say no, you better mean no. And for you to try to hide behind the level of oath or try to get someone to believe you because because you've sworn, instead of just saying I'll do it, you swear that you'll do it. That's something that is characteristic of individuals who are seeking loopholes, who cannot be trusted, whose integrity is not absolute, and that ought not to be the case with regard to Christians. So I think that's the general idea that's being established here. Now, going on beyond that, let me get this question asked, and then I can open it up for any discussion, or you can take issue with what I have to say. There are, and there were times, where God bears witness to an action, there are and were times when a Christian's word, though their honesty may be absolute and their integrity beyond reproach, to where because of regulations of men and circumstances, that's not sufficient for them. It should always be sufficient for you. This is where the importance lies. You should not be making a distinction. Yeah, I promised, but I didn't swear. And so because I didn't swear, even though I'm breaking this promise, it's not as big a deal as it would otherwise be. Yes, it is. It's every bit as big. But there are a couple of things that I want to know. A couple of passages. For example, in Malachi chapter 2 and verse 14, with regard to marriage. With regard to marriage, there is this statement. The Lord has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Now God bears witness to the I do's, in other words. And when you are in a marriage relationship and you are saying to your wife, do you take her to be your lawfully wedded wife, to have her and to hold her till death do you part, and you say I do, you are affirming before God, every bit as if you were to say, I do or I will in a court of law, that you are going to treat this woman as you should and that you're going to remain married to her. Now that's an affirmation that is made before God when you make that vow to your wife. It is a witness, a vow that is witnessed by the Lord. I'll give you a couple of other examples. I want you to go over to Numbers, the book of Numbers, in the fifth chapter. Numbers chapter 5. A couple of principles to kind of try to tie down that might be helpful to us in this. In Numbers chapter 5, and beginning in verse 19. In verse 19, in this particular case, it has to do with a wife who may or may not be unfaithful to her husband. I want you to notice what is said in, beginning in verse 19, the priest shall put her under oath and say to the woman, if no man has lain with you, you have not gone astray to uncleanness while under your husband's authority, be free from this bitter water that brings a curse. But if you have gone astray while under your husband's authority, and if you have defiled yourself and some man other than your husband has lain with you, then the priest shall put the woman under the oath of the curse. And he shall say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people, when the Lord makes your thigh rot and your belly swell, and may this water that causes the curse go into your stomach, make your belly swell, your thigh rot. This is horrible language, but that's what it says. And then notice what the woman says. The woman shall say, amen, so be it. So, this again is an oath that was given, which was an amen, amen, is basically what that's saying. And so the idea that I want to try to establish in this regard is that by affirming to a court of law, whatever legal requirement it is, when they require that, making the affirmation that yes, I am telling the truth, that all you are doing is acknowledging, because they require that acknowledgement, that you intend to be honest and tell the truth forthrightly. Your requirement is to do that whether you are under oath or not, whether there is any requirement that is given by law. So from what I'm looking at those kinds of principles, there's even a passage in 1 Thessalonians 5 where in verse 27 the Apostle Paul gave a charge that the epistle be read to all the holy brethren. And that charge is the same basic statement that is being made in the court of law. The same language is being used. And in fact, there are two different commentators that I read, which basically they contend that is actually positive authority for accepting the responsibility to tell to affirm in a court of law that you'll tell the truth, whole truth, nothing but the truth. Basically, he made the charge, and they accepted that charge. And that's the same thing when a charge is made to tell the truth in court of law, in accepting it. So, you know, whether you believe that 1 Thessalonians 5:27 is an actual positive authority for that practice, I think that when we look at the context, there would be nothing that would preclude, when it is required by civil law, for a Christian to affirm that, yes, I'm an honest person and I will be honest, to make that affirmation.
Stand there. Like you said, it is the law. If you're going to have a trial and you're going to testify, the only way that your testimony can be admitted into evidence is if you're sworn in. And it's put in there, if you do not tell the truth, then you will suffer the consequences of perjury. And so that, like I said, you can, if you don't want to swear, you can always say, I affirm.
Yeah, that again, that's the one thing about all of that that bothers me, is if an individual is unwilling to swear in a court of law, then he should be unwilling to affirm in a court of law, because the affirmation and the swearing, it's basically two different words that are synonymous and mean the same thing. So, in other words, in the court of law, a person who says, I swear, in the court of law, a person who says, I affirm, the same standard is set for both of them. You don't have a lower standard because you just say, I affirm, rather than I swear.
Yeah, you're just getting in there so you're legal.
So, yeah, we don't want to think that we as Christians can avoid this by using semantics and saying one thing rather than the other. And so if the question were to arise with regard to this, what a Christian, if you believe that it's unscriptural and sinful to make such an affirmation in a court of law, then what you need to do is not try to get around it with semantics by saying, I affirm rather than I swear. Simply refuse to do that. Now, there may be consequences to it, whether it be because you're unwilling to testify under oath, you don't get your testimony in, or perhaps you're held in contempt and go to jail as a result of it, but that's suffering for your faith. But recognize that based upon the principles that we've talked about this evening, many Christians, if not the majority of Christians, do not feel that they are in any way violating Jesus' teaching in this by making that positive affirmation when it is required of others.
You better not get involved in a lawsuit, because yeah, if you do, you get sued, you're going to have to do it.
Yeah. Or else?
Or you go to jail.
Or go to jail. That's exactly right. But again, if a Christian has to go to jail in order to protect his faith and go to jail, that's not,
yeah,
you know, that's,
yeah,
not, that's, well, we're not saying you don't do that, but I do believe that there are principles that would not require that. Okay?
James said, you're yes,
yeah,
no, no.
And that's the thing we need to take from it, is that you always tell the truth. Always tell the truth. You don't ever have the right to lie. Okay? Yeah. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today. We'll pick up with chapter 5 next week. One more week.